Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, July 22nd, 2026, we're delighted to host a discussion exploring the landscape of military law and best practices for JAGs. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Director of Networks here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, we've got a fabulous panel today and a lot to discuss. So at the risk of giving our speakers short shrift, I'm going to go ahead and give them very brief introductions so we can get into our discussion. If you'd like to know more about any of our speakers, I highly recommend you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we're fortunate to have with us Stephanie Fisher, who is Senior Appellate Counsel with the U.S. Navy and starts next week as a trial attorney at DOJ's National Security Division. We also have Mark Majors, who's Deputy General Counsel of the National Guard Bureau, Professor Michael Newton, who's the Director of the International Legal Studies Program at Vanderbilt Law School, and as our moderator, we have Jesse Burbank, who's Special Counsel at the U.S. Department of Defense. Then I'll leave it there. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Burbank, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Ms. Kleist. Thank you all for joining. Welcome to Exploring the Landscape of Military Law, Best Practices for JAGs. I'm Jesse Burbank. To start off, of course, all remarks here on the panel by myself or our distinguished panelists represent only our own personal views and don't necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or Defense, the Armed Services, or the institutions where we work. Because we're in our personal capacity, I'll also be a bit less formal than military customs and courtesies usually require, and I'll be using first names for our panelists. So to begin, military law, as you probably know, encompasses a wide range of disciplines: criminal law, national security, contracts, administrative law, regulatory. And this program is intended to give you a general high-level overview of what legal practice in the military looks like, the type of work that judge advocates do. And we'll also be talking a little bit about the application and sessions process, long-term trajectory of military legal careers, different opportunities across active duty, reserve, National Guard, and then finally, what exit options are often available to JAGs after they leave their service or go part-time. To begin, we will transition to our distinguished panelists here. Stephanie, starting with you, could you just give us a brief overview of upbringing, education, and what led you to start a career in military law?
Sure. So I was born and raised in Arizona. Both my parents were Marines, so I grew up with a very deep respect and admiration for service members. And I had always wanted to do it in some capacity, but until I decided to go to law school, I wasn't really sure what service in the military would look like for me and what a career option would be. And it just so happened that after graduating from the University of Michigan for undergrad, go Blue, I did medical sales for Abbott for 3 years. I was living and working in Virginia Beach. So all of my friends were essentially active duty military veterans. I was training and competing with them in CrossFit. So I got very immersed into that culture. And so once I decided to go to law school, I knew that's when I wanted to become a JAG. And that's finally the path that I could go towards service. So I was just very familiar with the military, the Marine Corps, the Navy, and I ended up choosing the Navy largely based on the fact that I think they have really great duty stations and I was familiar with the culture. So.
Getting ahead of us on choice of branches. Thank you, Stephanie. Mark, could you give us a quick overview of your upbringing, what led you to a career in military law?
Sure. Yeah. So my dad was active duty Army, grew up as a military brat per se, moving around different locations every 3 years. When I started college at Samford University in Birmingham, Alabama, my dad said, hey, if you're going to pledge a fraternity, you're going to do ROTC as well. So I started out in Air Force ROTC, wanted to fly jets. My eyes weren't great. And they gave me the option to be a missileer, which consists in the bottom sitting in a missile silo. They were like, oh, it's great. You're off 3 days and you're in the ground in a bunker for 3 days and vice versa. And I was like, oh, don't really want to do that. So got out, went to law school, but I was kind of missing it. And I had a paralegal at the first law firm I was at in Montgomery, Alabama. I was a member of the Alabama Guard. And she, I said, you know, hey, we're talking weekend plans. She said, I'm going to drill. And I was like, what do you mean drill? And she told me what she was doing. And I said, well, if you're interested, why don't you come down and talk to RSGA? So that was 1998. I joined the Alabama National Guard and I was still working 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year. And ended up, I did it for a lot of reasons. I kind of missed the military. You know, I missed that environment. And then I got deployed to Bosnia in 2001. My first day in office was September the 11th, 2001. And that had a profound impact on me. And I ended up leaving private practice a couple years after that and became AGR since then. And I've been doing it since. So it was not something I really planned on doing, but it really fulfilled a void that I'd been missing. And it's been a great opportunity for me.
Great. We'll turn to you, Mike, next.
Well, I'm easy. On paper, very predictable. You know, I side with Mark. I had terrible eyes and worse eyes now. I turned down the Air Force Academy to go to West Point, combat arms officer, funded legal guy. And I was aberrational and have been aberrational in many ways since. I came straight out of law school at the University of Virginia into special operations, which sort of paved the way because, and this is my one takeaway for every student, every person who's interested, just be a great lawyer. The Army JAG Corps saw the wood in front of you. And then the rest of it just kind of gradually happens. I was in the State Department on 9/11. I got to work at really great jobs. You can see all of our bios online. And we're all, I think, happy to answer questions offline. So the thing is, take every day, take every opportunity, just be a great lawyer or the best you can possibly be. And then the rest works itself out.
Thank you, Mike. So to start off, we'll do some foundation laying here. So generally, the armed services are divided into three components: active duty, reserve, and the National Guard. We have some exposure to each of those components across the panel here. So could you tell us what being a judge advocate looks like in general across these three components? And we'll start off with you, Mark.
Sure. And I'll give sort of the National Guard perspective for people that aren't familiar with it. So the National Guard operates in three different arenas. So you have state active duty and you have Title 32 status, Title 32 United States Code. In both of those statuses, the National Guard operates under the command and control of the governor. And when you're on state active duty, it's paid for by the state generally. There may be some federal reimbursement under the Stafford Act, depending on the emergency situations. And then you have under Title 32, you still operate under the command and control of the governor, but you're federally funded. Then the National Guard also operates in a Title 10 status, which is the same as your regular active duty or the reserve side. And that's another important distinction. The National Guard and the Reserve, even though they're always phrased as a reserve component together, they're really distinct in what they do. One of the major distinctions is that the National Guard is not generally subject to the Posse Comitatus Act when they're in a either the Title 32 status or state active duty, which distinguishes that. So that's why the National Guard is involved in a lot more of domestic missions as we have going on right now with a safe and beautiful mission that's going on in D.C., the missions we have going on in New Orleans, missions we have going on in Memphis, et cetera. And I had the opportunity 2 weeks ago where I had lunch with the Attorney General for Tennessee. And I asked him, I said, how is it the Guard is doing right now? He said, unbelievably, Memphis has only had 3 murders last month, which is so you see the impact that the Guard does. And as a military lawyer, you get to play certainly a role doing that from the Guard perspective. And, the Guard is also made up from both Army and Air side. Most of my viewpoint has been on the Army side. So that's one of the distinctions. But when the Guard is in the Title 10 status, they typically operate and do a lot of the same things that your active duty counterparts are engaged in as well, be that either military justice, administrative law, contract fiscal law, environmental law, and legal assistance, et cetera. So they still run the same gamut. The distinction being when the Guard is in a Title 32 or state active duty status, who their command and control runs through, and the fact that they can engage in a lot more domestic type missions that typically the active components are restricted from.
All right. Thank you, Mark. Mike, we'll turn to you next. I know you predominantly have active experience. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, lots. I think this is an important first question, because if you're around for more than 5 minutes, you're going to work in an interagency capacity and a joint capacity. You're going to work with all the armed forces, and you got to understand the cultural differences. We don't have one of my Coast Guard brethren and sister in here today. One of my former students just got posted to the Coast Guard Academy. So they play an important auxiliary role. They're part of the team, and you're going to deal with this. You're going to deal with activating people. You're going to deal with people ending their terms. I think there are huge cultural differences. But at the same time, everybody has swore the same oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And you've got to understand the strengths and weaknesses. I mean, I've deployed with reserve or National Guard Special Forces groups. I've deployed with, of course, active duty groups. I've deployed alongside Navy. I've been under Navy commanders. I think you really have to understand the cultural differences, which is why, just to lay my marker down, I'm not a huge fan or proponent of just a generalized purple service. I think it's important for us to incorporate and to enculturate, if that's even an English word, but with our client. We got to know our client. And a submarine service is different from a surface warfare officer, which is different from a special forces group, which is different from a National Guard MP commander, et cetera. And you've got to be the expert to know your client. And then the flip side is to be the expert in the law relevant to that client. I think that's our core function. And those are not vanilla differences. But at the same time, we have to understand those differences and totally work together in a harmonious, mission-focused, mission-centric way.
And Stephanie, you're uniquely positioned here because I understand you're transitioning from active to reserve. Could you talk about how your active experience was and how it might look differently now that you're transitioning to the reserve?
Sure. I'll just kind of go over the basics and the broad overview. So the active duty experience, at least on the Navy side, is you usually get assigned a billet for about 2 to 3 years. And it's either something that we call a shore tour, where you're not really going to deploy, or a sea tour, where you can expect a deployment. One of the great things about the Navy is we do have a lot of opportunities to deploy both at sea and on land, which I think is unique to the services. But I want to echo Mike's point that both my last two tours were actually joint commands. I worked for a retired Army Brigadier General, and I worked for an active duty Marine Corps colonel. So it definitely is important to get to know the services and understand the differences and the interplay. And so for me, I think transitioning from active duty to the reserves was very seamless. You really honestly just sign a couple forms. And just to speak to the reserve piece a little, it's really nice because you're obviously getting, if you do 1 good year of what they call act or reserve time, that counts towards 1 year of retirement. So that's a huge benefit. You're staying connected to the community. You're getting assigned to a unit where you continue to build skills for your resume and for your civilian capacity. And then on the reserve side of the house, I think there can actually be more opportunities sometimes than on active duty, because on active duty, your commander or boss can essentially say like, hey, we aren't able to let you go do this deployment or take this opportunity. Whereas on the reserve side of the house, if you volunteer and raise your hand, first of all, there's no one saying like, hey, you aren't able to volunteer for this. And second, if you get selected, there's no one saying, hey, you can't go. So I do think that's a great benefit of the reserves. And I really love wearing the uniform. And that's something that gives me a tremendous amount of pride. So while it was time for me to step up active duty, I was really glad to have the option to do the reserves.
And quickly, Stephanie,
can I add one quick note, Jesse?
Oh, go ahead, Mike.
One of the key differences in the active force, we're going to get shuffled around. We're going to have a baseline skill set in the reserves and in the National Guard. You can build long-term relationships with a core group of people. You can deploy with them, or in fact, you can deploy without them. I just had a conversation on Sunday with a really well-known, very successful corporate lawyer who wants to wear the cloth of the country and wants to serve. And that's what Stephanie said. He can join, he can deploy with or without a particular unit. And I think that's really important for people who are in the civilian side, looking at how do I balance all these competing priorities in a way that gives me personal and professional fulfillment.
And just real quick, Stephanie, could you just tell us the general time commitment for reserve? Generally 1 weekend a month, is that right, with a drill?
Yep. So drill time is what they call 1 weekend a month. So it's about the equivalent of 16 to 20 hours per month. And then there's 1 2-week continuous span through the year where you deploy to where your unit is assigned, or not deploy, but you go and train where your unit is based out of. And so with the reserves, you can, some of those opportunities, especially because they know lawyers are incredibly busy in their civilian capacity, I think they've shifted more towards some opportunities for people who want to do their 1 week in a month drill time remote. So don't let that deter you or think you're going to be gone or traveling all the time. There are certainly in-person ones, but there are opportunities to do remote. And so one of my pieces of advice for somebody that's looking at doing the reserves is just talk to people who are already in the reserves about the different units and what their experience has been like.
Awesome. Thank you. So, Mark, for this next one, could you just talk about what some of the main practice areas are that judge advocates tend to touch on? Of course, it's a vast potential portfolio, but could you give us an overview of what those might look like?
Yeah, and I think I kind of went over this initially, but before I start that, I would say what Stephanie was saying about, and Mike too, about the reserve, the guard is very similar. The distinction being in the guard, you know, if you join, you know, the Mississippi National Guard, which I'm a member of now, you're typically going to drill in that state and deploy with units from that state. The exception being we have a special forces unit, you know, the two of the special forces units that are in the National Guard, 20th Special Forces Group, which is generally the East Coast and South, Southeastern United States, and 19th Special Forces Group, which is generally West Coast, you know, mid part, with exception of a unit in West Virginia. They typically will deploy with their companies that are in battalions that are based out of other states. But that's kind of one of the distinctions about the Guard, is that you're going to serve with those people. And probably the lawyers that you drill with on the weekend are going to be lawyers that you're practicing in the state. They might be on the Court of Appeals in your state. They might be a district attorney in the state. They might be, you know, defense counsel. They may be a corporate attorney somewhere in the state. So I would say the Guard is much more of the people that you're going to like start out as lieutenants with. You're going to rise up through the ranks and probably deploy with those same people. So it's a little bit of a different environment than necessarily than some of the reserve side, where you may be flying, you know, living in Florida, but flying to Maryland to go to drill, et cetera. And even though the reserves are going to kind of drill together and you'll know some of those people, but you're not going to be generally seeing them, you know, every day that you go to or 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, or deployments as you would on that. But again, so back to the question on the practice areas. So I would say, you know, national security law, it's, you know, a lot of the same things that you're going to have on the active component side. And national security law, domestic operational law, administrative law, contract fiscal law, you know, environmental military justice, you know, policy legislation, legal assistance. Of course, you're going to be doing that. I know when I first started out, you know, I would go do legal briefings to units out on drill weekend, and then I would do wills, power of attorneys for those members, if to prep them. So in the event a deployment came up, invariably you would always get, you know, questions about, you know, hey, you know, my brother got a DUI, you know, what do I do on that? Can you help me out on that? Or they would call me on those things and I would tell them, hey, listen, you know, I'm not doing that in my National Guard capacity, but we can find somebody to help you out to do that as well. The litigation is also an area that you may be involved in and doing that as well. Now, typically that's handled a lot on the full-time side, but we had certainly, when I was in Mississippi, some very, very skilled, you know, litigation, civil litigation attorneys that we would bring in to help us out on big cases, labor and employment cases as well on that. And I think I mentioned the environmental side. So a lot of opportunities to do that. And I would say for a young attorney looking to cut their teeth, doing, you know, military justice matters, court martials on the weekends, you know, administrative separation boards is a great opportunity to do that. You may be at, you know, associate at a corporate firm and have no, you know, not really get a chance to do that. But if you're doing that on the drill weekend side, that those are skills that naturally transfer over, in my opinion, to the civil side as well. I will share this one thing. So I had an externship program with the Mississippi, when I was with the Mississippi National Guard, where I would take law students that would, you know, come from the two law schools inside the state. And we would get our third year law students, what we called third year cards. They're admitted to limited practice. And we enabled one of our externs to do a drug board, an administrative separation board for a soldier who was accused of using drugs. And this guy had interviewed before with that for active duty Air Force to get a slot. He didn't get a call back. He gets a call back for an interview the second time, but this time he's done this defense board. And so the judge advocate that was interviewing says, so tell me about this defense. I've never done a defense. I've never defended or prosecuted a board. Tell me what all you did on that stuff. So he went the whole thing and the guy was separated. I think he left out the fact that the soldier did not actually show up to defend the case. So the person was separated, and he second chaired that. But he, even though he was second chair, he was able to argue a lot of that stuff, and a great opportunity. But that led him to get an active duty extension for him to be able to commission as a judge advocate on active duty. So those are the things I think that enable attorneys to build those trial skills and cut their teeth in areas maybe they haven't gone. And I think some of the things I think that Mike and Stephanie also echoed is, I would say, if you're looking to do this and you want, and maybe I'm getting heading myself a little bit, I've given a lot of different practice areas, but I think some, you know, and people maybe have their areas of practice that they want to do, but I had an old football coach used to say, if it doesn't challenge you, it's not going to change you, you know. And I would say the same is true in the military. So take those hard assignments, because it'll make you a well-rounded attorney, and you'll be able to, I think, to improve yourself as well, and take those different opportunities and make your military career and your practice much more challenging and exciting and rewarding.
Great. Mike, could you tell us a little bit about different practice areas that you've seen available in active, how often people might shift between them, or whether people act as jack of all trades often sometimes?
Well, I'm going to be a little contrarian, in part because of my special operations background. You have to be a great attorney at every phase, which means, of course, you're equipped to do all the whole range of things, environmental, you know, dealing with an ICRC in a deployment setting, dealing with Human Rights Watch in the national security space, you know, briefing somebody that's going to send something immediately to a geographic commander, which you know is going to the White House. You have to be an expert at all levels. You're going to be the one on the ground that's going to try a case, that's going to do a separation board, et cetera. But here's my counter-majoritarian impulse, which is to say, if you get sucked along in the river current of normal JAG service, it can be very fulfilling. And if that's what you want, great. Build towards your retirement, you know, build your points in reserve branches, retire, do your thing. But for me, big picture, I think you have to develop over time a deep expertise in a particular area. And this is counter-majoritarian, I know. But the military, in all of my meetings in the White House, nobody ever said, what does the Army think? We're in the execution business. We're in the business of taking operational orders and JCS execute orders and implementing them. But that is not permanent. None of us will be in uniform our entire waking existence. I think it's incumbent upon all of us to develop a depth and a real expertise in the area that really, really builds our internal soul, and use that as a fulcrum or a leverage to post-retirement or post-service life. We have to take care of our families. We have to feed our professional soul. So at the same time, these are a little bit of tension here. You got to be a great lawyer in the generalist spaces. But at the same time, if you want to be a litigator, be the best litigator out there and maybe go be a military judge, or maybe go transition in the Office of Immigration and Litigation at DOJ or wherever it is. But I think you have to build a deep expertise, because when the chips are down, you are the lawyer. And I can't emphasize that enough. You are the lawyer at whatever level, national or at a platoon level. And you are the one that has to have their ducks in a row and have a deep expertise in the area. And when you speak with knowledge and experience and full research. And I think over time, you build a depth of expertise that serves you well in the long term, because you never know. You may jump out of an airplane and mess up your back and be medically retired in a year. You just never know. You have to be prepared to be a lawyer, and a great lawyer, both in civilian practice and in military practice. And that's just my perspective.
Thank you, Mike. And I know it's always an ongoing discussion in the Corps over whether you want to specialize or remain some level of generalist. How would you reflect on the types of practice areas that are available, Stephanie?
Sure. So I'll talk to the Navy a little more specifically. I know we're a little bit different than some of the other services. We really focus on two main things, and that is either litigation or national security law. So there are some attorneys that will do environmental or administrative law, but that's a much, much smaller percentage. And in the Navy, I do think it is good to be well-rounded, and you do want to take maybe a tour that is not specifically one or the other, but I do think they look a little more towards specialization and primarily those two things. So in the Navy, you can go to litigation, you can be a trial or defense counsel, you can do it, so prosecutor, defense counsel, you can do it at the trial or appellate level, you can be a military judge, a victim's legal counsel. So there's a number of different roles within that. And then on the essentially what we call national security law side, you're generally advising operational commanders, as Mike was talking about, or other very high level principles on a matter of things. So that could look like the law of armed conflict, rules of engagement, maritime and international law, intelligence authorities. So at least within the Navy, they really kind of look at having you do one of those two routes. And if you go in thinking one thing and you change your mind, that's okay. But I would say come your second, or at least by like when you're selecting orders for your third tour, you really kind of have an idea of what you want to do with your career and where you want to take it. And if I had never joined the Navy JAG Corps, I don't think I would have been going into the field of national security law, which I now love and is incredibly dear to my heart. So it was a really great experience for me, and it really helped me figure out what fulfills me and what I want to do for the rest of my career.
Great. Thanks, Stephanie. I think you're ideally positioned for this, too, because you're seeing how this transition works in real time.
Sure.
Next, let's go ahead and turn to the application process for becoming a judge advocate. What would you say makes a successful JAG application? And can we go ahead and actually start with you, Stephanie?
Sure. So this is probably similar for all the branches, but again, I speak a little more from a Navy perspective. Our application process is a short written application followed by a structured interview, which they ask every single person the same series of questions. And what I think they're looking for is essentially the concept of, do you understand and have you demonstrated service above self, that you're a good teammate, that you can make, that you have a strong, essentially backbone and strong character, because you're going to be called on to make incredibly difficult decisions in real time with incomplete information that impact people. So they want to know that essentially when it comes down to it, that you're capable of making those decisions. And then, so again, my pitch for, you know, the JAG Corps is one of those things is you do get so much real world experience and responsibility so quickly off the bat, and that continues for your whole career. So to me, that's what I think the service is really looking for. And then they, of course, just want to know, you know, why the military? And if you're interviewing for a specific branch, also speaking to maybe why that specific branch over others.
Great. Mark, how would you say a successful application for National Guard JAG looks?
Well, I would say the first part would be to see if you want to join the State Guard, the National Guard for your state, to make sure that they have a licensing requirement. Sometimes, you know, you may be practicing in the corporate world or whatever else, or in the D.C. area working for a government agency, but you're not licensed in Virginia or whatever state it is. So there may be a state requirement on that. But I would say, and I posted it in the chat link. So if you go to I think it's jagcnet.army.mil. There's a link on there for under the National Guard where it has the judge advocate screening officers. So that's going to have all of your National Guard officers, two for each state or territory. So you have 54 to choose from. And I would email them directly to contact them. Go by for an interview. Tell them what you know you're interested in doing. There are some age waivers if you're over the age of 33, but generally those are granted. I would say if you are going to need an age waiver, you probably want to be able to show that you can meet the physical demand of being able to do that. I would recommend people as like, you know, assuming they're fit enough to do it, and they typically go through MEPS and get the medical clearance and make sure they're good to go. There's no issues with that. But I would be like, hey, here's my local 5K times, or here's my half marathon times, or here's my Marine Corps marathon time that I ran, you know, to show that, hey, even though I'm, you know, 38, 39, I can still perform at the same level and make the same time cuts as 25-year-olds can do. So I think that's important. You know, I know one case we had somebody that needed an age waiver. I think they were 43, but they were an MMA fighter. And, you know, this guy was just like, he definitely got his waiver done on that. And I remember meeting the guy and just like, what an incredible opportunity to do that. But there's no way that the Army is going to be, or the National Guard is going to say, well, this guy's not going to be able to make the cut. For people that maybe didn't have, you know, weren't law review, you know, weren't in the top 10% of their class, that's not as much of an issue, I think, on the guard side of the house. It's certainly because most of our applicants are a little bit older. And if you can show that, hey, these are the other things that I've done, I've got $1 million verdicts, I've gotten, you know, defended the, you know, whatever death penalty cases, I've done all these other things to show that, you know, you're a capable attorney. And even though maybe you, you know, got distracted with quote unquote bar reviews when you were in law school and maybe didn't make all your classes and took all the cuts you could take, you could show that you know, you've passed the bar and you've gone under great things as well. If there are problems areas, typically you also require a waiver if you failed the bar exam more than twice. So also be prepared to address that if you're in that. I wouldn't say it's a showstopper, but you know, everything is, you know, for the most part, a lot of things are waivable on that, but you have to show that whatever problem area that is there, that you can definitely overcome that. And because, you know, the National Guard, typically we invest in an applicant not for 6 years or 8 years, the minimum service required. We're investing in you for 28 to 30 years. So you want to make sure that you're coming there to be part of the family, be a performer, be a team player, and be, as I said before, be willing to take those hard assignments, hard jobs, the mobilizations, et cetera, that are out there. And I think that is a perfect way to get to yes. And the last thing I want to mention, I think I covered this, if not, but I want to address it again. You do have to be in shape to do that. So if you've got, you know, some issues where you're concerned about your weight, I would definitely get in shape, make sure to drop those pounds, et cetera, to make sure when you have that interview that you're not going to be on the quote, the fat body program, to do, you know, and have it to be under a wave or under a flag the whole time you're in the service, because that's also going to be a showstopper as well.
Yeah, definitely want to avoid the body composition
restriction. Right.
Mike, could you go ahead and talk about what a successful accessions application looks like?
Yeah, well, let me pick up on that. I mean, I think the fitness piece is vital, particularly for the Army, not so much for the Navy. No offense, Stephanie. Just kidding. But the fact is that that's vital, not just in terms of getting accessed, but of earning the respect of commanders. Right, who have standards, who are enforcing that. And it's completely hypocritical for you to board somebody out for physical reasons when you can't pass a PT test yourself or struggle. I'm like, I'm 64 and I could go tomorrow and take an APFT with a special forces unit in the 30 standard and be just fine. I think that's a vital part of your personal credibility as a lawyer, and your professionalism. And the fact is, when you say you want to be an officer in the United States Armed Forces, that's part of it. And it's everything from the searing heat of Iraq to a mission, I mean, you name it, in a deployment setting, it's that physical tenacity, or on the flip side, just the physical tenacity. I got out of travel at 11:30 last night. I need to be in the office tomorrow morning around 4 a.m. to prepare because I've got a 7 a.m. start date. Bring it. And if we go for 2 weeks, fine. I have the physical stamina to do that. So this is not just rhetoric or talk about T levels or whatever. It's about doing your job and doing your job well. The second thing I'd say, the big thing, is about values. What they're really looking for are that you understand service culture and service values of professionalism and discipline and loyalty. And it's funny, and at Vanderbilt, I said to somebody probably a decade ago, I said, you know, I'm loyal to you. And they said, loyalty is not a word we use in our business. Well, excuse me, it is part of my vocabulary. It's part of my values. And that's what they're looking for, people who understand selfless service, people who understand duty above self, people who understand, who aren't just egomaniacs. Like for me, I'm filtering out egomaniacs. I need people that can fit into a team, that know their role, that want to share credit, that want to build great units. And the lawyer ethos for judge advocates, I think, is rare and misunderstood. And it's just that. Remember, you're the advisor, you're the technical expert. But at the end of the day, it's going to be some commander, whether it's at the National Command Authority or at the Joint Staff or in a you know, brigade or battalion commander or a ship driver who's going to make those decisions. You have to be part advocate, part ethicist, part philosopher, part lawyer, part trial lawyer. And at the end of the day, you're the legal expert, and you have to be prepared in a holistic way to deliver on all those fronts.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Next, let's go ahead and turn to what exit opportunities look like for judge advocates. Of course, active and some elements of the Guard are generally full-time jobs. What does it look like when a judge advocate decides to transition from active service, either out of the service or to part-time service? And could we actually go ahead and start with you, Mike?
Well, we can, only because, I mean, people can Google. I had a very atypical transition. I was hired on a handshake deal and over breakfast. But it was because people looked you in the eye and they knew what you were about, and they made a leap of faith. And that's 22 years ago now. So there it is. There are any number of pathways. I have two critical pieces of advice, maybe three or two and a half, for people that are looking for a transition. Item first, you plan for it from the first day of service, which doesn't mean, and don't hear me to be saying, you ever short circuit uniform service. But you owe it to your family, you owe it to yourself to develop your expertise, and you gotta write. You gotta be a critical thinker. That's the second thing. Never be content just to do the bare minimum and sort of float along and accrue your reserve points. You know, in active duty, you're gonna be busy. All the armed services, all the branches are short-staffed. We're under-personed. You know, there's not enough time to go around. There, you know, demands, the urgent versus the important every single day. I just got an email. And then my third piece of advice is just be a great person, be a great partner, be a great teammate. I just got an email completely random from somebody that I served with back in, it would have been 1995. Totally out of the clear blue, some 30 years later, saying, hey, I'll never forget the role you played in my life. I'm a young captain. Blah, 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 blah. Be a great partner, because that's where your exit opportunities come from. Every great opportunity you will ever have, both in civilian life, and Mark and Stephanie will agree with this, I know, will come from a friend. Somebody who says, hey, I can't do that, but you got to call Stephanie. And at a baseline self-serving way, those are the people that become your letters of reference, et cetera. But in my experience, it's just being a great lawyer and being a great partner and being a great teammate to do your job and make everybody else look good. And if you get credit, you get credit. But that's not the point. That's not why you're ever doing anything. Marcus Aurelius, and I'll close with this. Why, like a fool, if you've done a good thing and you've done your duty, that's me paraphrasing, and someone else has benefited, why, like a fool, would you ever ask for a third thing, credit? We don't work for credit. We do our jobs. And if we get it, great. But we're about fitting in and molding and being a great, reliable, mission-focused partner. And from that, that's where civilian opportunities come from. And I can give you a lot more detail on that if you want.
Awesome. Thanks, Mike. Now, Stephanie, you're sort of going through this in real time. Could you talk about how you approached exit opportunities from active Navy?
Absolutely. So first, I'm going to echo most of what Mike said, which is number one, be a good person, be somebody that other people want to work with. So that's both being just a good human being overall and being competent at your job. And that will take you incredibly far in the JAG Corps, in civilian practice, in life. The other thing too is I would give the same advice I'd really give for any job to people, network, find mentors, and just be curious. And so with networking, you want to network both within the JAG Corps, and it may not seem like that's so obvious because of the way the JAG Corps works. But the other thing too is I really did think at first I was going to do 20 years, but I continued to network outside of the JAG Corps and be involved in other organizations such as the Federalist Society. And when it came time that I was actually like, I'm going to look to transition out, that network was incredibly valuable. And even my job kind of came initially about from somebody that I had actually interned with on the Arizona Supreme Court, reaching out to somebody else and saying, hey, this is a really great person for your organization. I know they're interested. You like, let me send you their resume and I'd highly recommend them. And so I think what Mike said is incredibly important. Network within the JAG Corps and network outside of the JAG Corps. And then I think you don't have to know exactly what you wanted to do. I knew I wanted to practice national security law, so all of my search was geared towards that. But when you're starting to think about getting out, talk to mentors, talk to friends, talk to people who have already made the transition, and just kind of get a feel for what life can look like. But there's so many exit opportunities. I know lots of JAGs, both in and out of the reserves, that work in high levels in government. They work as in-house counsel. They're high-level partners at big law firms. So really, the entire world is open to you. And another thing that Mike said is, one thing is when I was interviewing, I often interviewed with people who were not JAGs, but they always told me all the JAGs we have that work for us are incredibly hardworking, very competent, and are just good people. And so the JAG Corps really does carry that reputation. And then the last thing I'll know is the JAG Corps is often nicknamed the world's largest firm. And that is very true. So when you join the JAG Corps, you're really joining a community and a very tightly bonded group. And so those recommendations, and just even if you don't know another JAG, they're often willing to reach out and help another JAG, whether they're starting out in their career or they're looking to transition out. So you're really building a great network just by being a JAG and serving.
Now, Mark, National Guard or the Reserve often coexist with civilian professions and people's professional lives. But could you talk about how the Guard can complement people's professional lives, or how people exit out of AGR occasionally to other opportunities?
Well, first, I'd like to talk about, and I'm stealing a line from General Arizaga. He used to say that if you're leaving active duty, don't think about you have two options, the reserve or the guard. You have 55 options, you know, because you have the reserve, plus you have 54 other states and territories to be able to choose from. And I would say, you know, the great things about that, for especially if I'm speaking to folks that are active duty and have been used to having TRICARE, or folks that are in the private sector, you still have an opportunity to get TRICARE insurance, which when I was in private practice some 20 something years ago, I was paying in the neighborhood of $500 to $700 for family coverage. I know that's gone up astronomically since then. And I think now it's like maybe for family coverage is maybe $150. It's certainly a steal. And you have the opportunity to go to great doctors. Even if you're not near a military treatment facility, there's a lot of doctors in the private sector certainly take that type of medical care. So I would say that's an avenue. I would say too that there's the Jobs for JAGs, which is done by the Judge Advocate Association. I think about every February timeframe. That's also a great opportunity for people leaving active duty that are looking to what something to do in the private sector. And like both Mike and Stephanie said, the networking opportunities are tremendous in the reserve components, in the Guard, and in the Judge Advocate community in general. Now, this is not to say, you know, if you're not if you've not performed up to your abilities on that, your reputation is probably going to carry to that. But most of hopefully the people I'm speaking to will realize that if they've done a great job in those other areas, it's naturally going to open other doors and opportunities for them. A lot of the things we're doing, I think, as Mike talked about and Stephanie hinted on as well, is we're problem solvers. So maybe you're exposed to a different type of problem area, but we're working solutions. And certainly in the JAG community, you're working at the highest level for senior general officers and military members, and sometimes on the state side as well, or high level on the civilian side as well. So you've had your opportunity to be tested and tried, and generally have performed well. But I would say that for instance, in the National Guard, we have two of our attorney generals, one for South Carolina and who just actually won the Republican primary for governorship, as well as the attorney general for Arkansas, are both judge advocates in the Guard. So you have those type of opportunities. I'm going to an investiture in about 3 weeks for a JAG that I recruited, who's going to be invested as the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Mississippi. So, and a lot of the opportunities that these people had came about because of their military connections and what they did and the job opportunities they got to do in the Guard. So like I said, it's a great opportunity to kind of build that resume and make you stand out from other people.
Great. Thank you, Mark. So we will do one more question from me for our distinguished panelists, and then we'll turn to the Q&A function. Just a heads up, if you have a question that you would like the panel to address, please go ahead and drop that in the Q&A chat. Now, Mike, could you just give us some advice in general terms for students or attorneys out there considering a career in military law. This could be how to approach the question of whether to join up, how to advocate for themselves throughout the course of a military career, whichever direction you'd like to take it.
Well, I'll say two things. Number one, be true to yourself, which may be counterintuitive. I mean, I know sometimes in civilian circles, there's this perception of military in general, but particularly military lawyers, as just being the drones, the answer machine, the yes people. Nothing could be further from the truth. The best lawyers are the ones who have the moral courage and the true sense of self to be true to themselves, because you have a very, very special relationship with commanders or you know, at all levels, a national command all the way down to a company level. You know, you can close the door and say, I'm talking to you as your lawyer. Let me tell you what's right, and let me tell you what I advise. And it doesn't go any further than that. And trust me, because I've seen it 100 times, you can completely change. So number one, be true to yourself. Stephanie said it earlier. Number two, keep learning. Be curious. Don't just know some simple little garbage answer about the law of war from some stupid JAG school outline because you memorized one sentence and 5 key words. Be the expert. Be the one who could say, oh, well, I just looked at the new 2025 ICRC revision of the commentary on the 4th Geneva Convention, and I disagree with it for the following reasons. You should have that technical depth, and that's just one of hundreds of examples. Have the technical depth to know exactly what you're talking about. And then I think the third thing, and this is maybe unique to my career, but I think you have to have a big view. How is what I'm doing in the trenches today translate to civilian litigation under the Torture Victim Protection Act, for example, or the Alien Tort Act, or the tort, you know, whatever, lots of things. I think you have to have the big view, because the lawyers on the ground, the JAGs on the ground, are doing things in real time that have strategic consequences. And we've all seen that lots and lots of occasions. Easy example, I litigated the Bemba case at the International Criminal Court in the Appeals Chamber. And it's nothing more complicated than what should the lawyer have advised on the ground under that set of facts at the time. And it's a command responsibility case. Nothing more complicated than that. The current kerfuffle about the International Criminal Court and Secretary Rubio's statement. At the end of the day, every decision you make to prosecute, not to prosecute, to enforce discipline, to enforce regulatory structures has strategic consequences. And you can never forget that, because you're serving at both the micro and the macro level. I mean, one of my pet peeves is the fact that we had an Army JAG captain on the ground at Abu Ghraib. And if that person is aware of what's going on in a command and doing their job and walking the perimeter at night, Abu Ghraib comes out very differently. And we can all give lots of other examples. So I think at the end of the day, that's my big advice. Do the job that's in front of you, but never forget that everything you do has much larger consequences, because, and it's prosaic, I know, but you swear to support and defend the Constitution, and you're wearing an American flag on your shoulder. And I think, you know, if you live into both of those dual responsibilities, be a great lawyer in the micro, but never forget that everything you do has macro consequences, both in litigation, in federal court, in state court, at the ICC, with the ICRC, with Human Rights Watch, whatever the institution. And you're the one on the ground that knows the facts and is a true expert in the law. And I think if you do that, you'll have a great career. And there'll be a lot of people who forget some of those pieces along the way, and then other people come along and sort of quietly mentor them, take them by the elbow. I think you can have a great career if you do it right. And more importantly for me, you do it for the right reasons.
Great. Thank you, Mike. Mark, what advice would you have for students or attorneys that are considering joining JAG, or for how they can forge a path through one of the various JAG corps?
Yeah, so I would say for a law student, I would definitely talk about trying to do a summer externship with one of the active boots. I know the Army has that. I know the, I think the Air Force and the Navy does as well, just to get that exposure. Now, not everybody gets picked up for that. So I would say the other thing to do would be to check with your law school, and especially if you're in a law school in a major metropolitan area that has the Joint Force Headquarters for the National Guard, you can probably do an elective and be able to serve as an externship with their military department side. What a great opportunity to find out more about what they do on a day-to-day basis. And as I gave that example earlier, maybe get your third-year card and do an administrative separation board, hopefully get a separation, or possibly on the defense side and have the soldier retained to be able to take the opportunity to, and go into to the interview with that behind you. I would say that's it. Definitely, we talked about make sure you're staying in shape. You want to have good grades. I would make sure that you're a well-rounded applicant. You've done things other than just, we always want to say, hey, great, try to do moot court, be on a law review. Those are great as well. But there are other opportunities as well. If your law school has a military justice society, I would certainly want to join that. If they have a veterans and law clinic, I would volunteer that time as well, because you're going to be exposed to maybe some other reserve component JAG or active duty JAGs or retirees that'll have those connections and be able to write those good letters of recommendation for you. But all that kind of goes into it, as well as what we said before: make sure you're staying in shape, hopefully, if you're clearing up any medical issues that you may have on that. So great opportunity to do that. But, like I said, as we all sort of talked about, reach out to the judge advocates, to other judge advocates that you know, and tell them you're interested, and they can get you pointed in the right direction.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And finally, Stephanie, we'll give you the last word on advice that you have for people that might be interested in the JAG Corps or who are early in the career in the JAG Corps.
Sure. I will keep this very brief. Do it. They always say that you'll regret more the things that you didn't do than the things that you did do. And I think for me, if I hadn't served, that's something I would always look back on and wonder or think, oh, I should have done that. And your active duty commitment is only 4 years. That goes by in a flash. I mean, you spend 3 years in law school. So my kind of high level advice is, if you're on the fence or you're not sure, do the 4 year commitment and then go from there. So,
yep. Can I add a two finger on that?
Sure thing, Mike.
Yeah. So one of my guys, and I have close to 60 students now, former students in all branches, and doing great stuff out there in the real world in uniform. One of my guys who was a direct accession comes to me as a 3L, having already accepted a law firm offer. And he made the following statement. He said, I've spent my time in law school. Mark's advice was good with the student law group. He'd been in classes with my veterans. He said, those are the people who I want to serve with. And to pick up Stephanie's strand, those are the people that I want to, in that first 3 or 4 years, learn how to be a lawyer with. That's my people. That's my culture. Direct accession. He just got back from being deployed in a very, very, very high profile mission, and he's totally fulfilled. And, whether he stays in or not at this point is background noise. Right. In the first 5 years of service, he's done more than many people do in a career and is totally equipped. And I'll revert, because you've heard me say this 2 or 3 times. He's a great young lawyer. You can take that skill set and that baseline of experience, in Stephanie's case, to DOJ National Security Law Division and not skip a beat, or onto a law faculty, or into a U.S. attorney's office, or into whatever it is you want to do. Into a state AG's office. One of my former veterans works for the Tennessee AG's office. And that's the point, is you owe it to yourself in that first 3 or 4 or 5 years to get that professional foundation that will then translate into every other area of practice.
Great. Thank you, Mike. We're now going to turn to the question and answer. We'll do a little bit of a speed round, because we have quite a few great questions here. Unfortunately, we'll only get to probably a few. We have one from Scott Whitford. He says that he's being recruited by both Marine JAG and Navy JAG, and asked for advice on how to make the decision between those two. I think that we can also zoom that question out a little bit. And talk about generally how to make the decision between which branch might be the best fit for you if you are interested in joining the JAG.
I would say try to go to the Army first. And if you can't get in the Army, then look at the other two.
Well, we'll start with you, Mark. Oh, you're on mute right now.
Mayor Coble. So, on that issue, like, you know, certainly I prefer the Army side of the house. All the services have great, different things that they offer, that, you know, they're, you know, pros and cons, depending on your viewpoint. I'm certainly preferential to the Army side, but I have served with the Marines and I have deployed with, the team 3 and team 4, with the Navy, when I did some time in Bahrain. So I've had an opportunity to serve with a lot of the other, all of them have great, very, very talented people. It's kind of maybe what you're looking for. I would say, you know, I don't know between the Navy, Marine, which one to choose. You know, if you're a more physical environment, you want to be on the ground, not doing floats. If you want to, you know, be involved in that, maybe go the Marine Corps route. I guess Stephanie can maybe probably offer more insight on that. If you want the most comfortable living, I would probably go the Air Force route.
And Stephanie, could you chime in as well, either on the specific question of Marine versus Navy or just generally how people think through that choice?
Sure. I'm going to caveat this with, please reach out to me after. I'm happy to discuss more in detail. But yeah, I think the big thing is just talking to JAGs within each service so you can really get a picture of kind of what the differences within those services and serving as a JAG is. A big one just between Navy and Marine Corps is, in the Marine Corps, everybody is a rifleman first. And so you're going to go to all of the training that every single Marine goes to, whereas in the Navy, you do OCS for 13 weeks and then Naval Justice School, actually, with your Marine counterparts. And so the Marine Corps JAG views each of their JAGs. They don't have a true JAG Corps, but there are the JAG MOS within the Marine Corps. So that's a difference to think about, but they work very closely together. So each one has their differences. Talk to JAGs within them, and then please reach out to me offline. I'm happy to connect you to Marine JAGs as well.
Now, moving for time, Mike, Renee Jackson asks, well, she notes that she's a First Tour Navy JAG, and asks, what are the best ways for First Tour JAGs to stand out for a performance without creating a competitive culture?
Yeah, well, let me comment really quickly on the Marine-Navy thing. I think there's a slight cultural difference. Stephanie's right, of course. The Marine Corps is going to be much smaller, and this is what I'd say to Renee, is the key components of being a great lawyer and standing out, to me, are no more complicated than two simple things. Number one, you're not a whiner. You know, you're a problem solver. You always bring a solution. You're not just sitting around complaining and identifying problems. And number two, and I say this all the time to my students, and it's good advice, if your peers, you know, if there's a heavy duty mission or an impossible case or a deployment where you're, you know, the Navy, of course, has a geographic focus, whereas the Marine Corps is going to be much more aligned with particular units. Going back to the previous question, if you want to be in a unit culture that's a very small culture, go Marines. You want to be in a much more diverse, diffuse culture, stay in the Navy. But if your peers voted on in this incredibly complex situation, and they can take one young lawyer, who would it be? Your peers would elect you as being the best person in a deployment setting, the most reliable, the best partner, the best lawyer. And by the same token, not in a self-serving way, the leadership would select you. I think that's what you do to stand out. You write, you think, you push boundaries. Just be a great person and be a great lawyer. And those attributes, as simple as they sound, are rare enough, even in the military, dare I say, you know, because there's a lot of dirtballs out there. There's a lot of people that are egomaniacs. There's a lot of misogynists out there. You're not any of those things. And I think that's the trick, is having both of those things meld, that you're the no-brainer selection for this impossible case or this six-month deployment or whatever it is. And from that comes a lot of personal credibility and professional credibility. When you say, I really want to go leave, Stephanie, to go be in the National Security Law Division, they say the following: we hate to lose you. We cannot stand the thought of losing you, but we will support you because we respect you. I think that's the trick. And that's the sentence when you know you're there at that level, but then you're buying into new challenges. So the third thing I'd say to Renee is never quit learning. Always stay curious. Stay growing constantly. And your career will grow into that. It's like a puppy growing into its big paws. Your career will grow into those expertise.
If I could also offer this, I will say, you know, of the services, I'm preferential to the Army JAG School located in Charlottesville, Virginia, you know, right next to the UVA Law School, probably one of the best places that you can go to school. The Army also offers the graduate course, an LLM, to people that want to go as well. Other services come as well, but just about all Army active duty judge advocates, once you make that transition to major, are going to get be sent to the Army JAG School to get an LLM, a 10-month program, and that opportunity is also available for the reserve, as well as guard judge advocates to attend as well. And other services send there, I think, in smaller numbers, of course, but send their judge advocates there as well. So a lot of opportunity for specialized training is out there as well. The Navy also offers what's called the Fleet Seminar Program, an opportunity to get for any judge advocate really wants to do it, or any federal personnel, federal GS employee, I think 11 or higher can get can do that, the Fleet Seminar Program, and basically get a master's in defense security studies from the Navy War College. So great opportunities out there to continue learning. And I would say that's probably one of the biggest values I've seen, and I've encouraged people to do all the time, is take advantage of that free education. It's one of the few jobs that's out there that's going to give it and reward it when you do it.
All right. Thank you, Mark. I see we're at time. Anything you'd like to have as a closing word, Stephanie?
The one thing I'll say, and I'll speak a little more to the newer JAGs, is especially for those of you that are first tours, take every opportunity you can to volunteer for things. If there's a deployment that pops up or otherwise an underway or even just an exercise, because what happens is once you get that one opportunity, then you're able to say, hey, I have some experience in that my peers don't. And then you'll get selected for more and more. And so it kind of builds on itself. So the younger you are in your career, volunteer as much as you can for those extra opportunities, and that will take you very far.
Great. And just to reiterate, all three of our panelists are happy to field questions if you reach out to them directly as well. Now I'll pass it over to you, Jayla.
Thanks so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, really appreciate you all joining us today and sharing your expertise and insight. It's been a fabulous discussion. Really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.